from tragedy to triumph.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of Tragedy to Triumph. I'm your host, Aaron Lane, a recovering alcoholic and drug addict who has dreams and aspirations of doing big things. Now, I've been clean and sober since 2016, and I believe that everything up to that point has shaped the man that I am today. On a daily basis, we hear tragic stories, and our goal is to present you with amazing success stories of people who have gone from tragedy to triumph. My guest today is the amazing Kyle Kleinfelder. And Kyle, before we get into the story of your use and transformation, why don't you give the listeners an idea of what you're all about?
My name is Kyle. I'm 31 years old. I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio. I was born on the west side of Cincinnati. I struggled with drugs and alcohol for about 14 years. And when I was 28 years old, I got sober, and I started to work in the recovery field. And today I work at Hotel California by the Sea, Cincinnati, in Blue Ash, and I'm the site manager at the treatment facility. And yeah, man, life's good, you know?
Dude, you know, it's always so funny to me is that everybody I talk to has some way of giving back, right? Yeah. And that is, it seems to be a huge part of your life.
Absolutely.
But you weren't always anticipating that that's what you would be doing.
No.
So if we can rewind the clock a bit and start up, you know, so you're from the west side of Cincinnati. What was it like growing up?
Well, when I was a child, I grew up in a good neighborhood. It wasn't a bad neighborhood, but my addiction led me to the bad parts of the west side. And I grew up in Delhi Township. I had a mom and a dad in the same house with my sister. And really, as a child, I was a good kid. I mean, I got in trouble sometimes, you know, just like kids do. I played a lot of sports. My dad kept me real busy in sports my whole life, and I was good at them.
What did you play?
I played football, baseball, basketball. I wrestled.
So you were like really into sport.
Yes,
okay, I thought
yes.
You made just one, and you were grew up in Delhi. Where'd you go to school?
I went to C.O. Harrison Elementary School. I went to Rapid Run Middle School. Then I went to Oak Hills High School.
Oak Hills.
Yes.
Which is a great school,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, great school.
So you grew up, I mean, really, as you said, mom and dad, you have a sister. Is she older or younger?
She's 18 months older than me.
So she's just a little bit older. No real trauma and like growing up. Like your parents were good. They were around. Your dad said, you said he had you in sports. What about your mom? What was she like?
Well, my mom, you know, she divorced my dad when I was about 10 years old.
Oh.
She found a new boyfriend and she left with him. And that was really like the first thing in my life where I was really, really angry, I guess you could say. Was wondering why, you know, just
did you ever feel responsible or anything? Or
no, I never felt responsible, but I think I was hurt more than anything.
Felt abandoned,
yes,
really. You're like,
yeah.
My mom left, like you, and she got a boyfriend. Really quick, or was it
she cheated on my dad with this man?
So,
and, she ran off with him, and I kind of didn't. I wasn't around my mom for a while throughout that because we were mad at her
and hurt.
And we didn't want to see her new boyfriend, and you know, so kind of my dad was my rock my whole entire life.
Gotcha.
My dad was there for me since I was born. You know, and But the bad thing is I put him through probably the most because I always lived with him, you know. So
just I want to sit here for a second, right? So you're about 10 years old. Your parents get divorced. Your mom had cheated on your dad with another man.
Correct.
And you looked at that as, you know, it made you angry and hurt. And you wanted nothing to do with your mom. So
no.
She wasn't really involved in your, like, your teenage years? Or was she, you know, a little bit or...
Yeah, she was. About a year after the divorce, I started to come around, and just because I missed my mom, I wanted to see my mom.
Yeah, well, and, you still loved her.
Yeah, I still loved her. I was just mad at her.
Were you able to tell her at the time that you were mad at her?
Oh yeah.
How would that go? Look,
yeah. I mean, we used to argue on the phone all the time when I was a kid. I believe I told her I've hated her on the phone when I was a kid.
Most kids tell their parents at one point, I hate you.
Yeah, I can't stand you.
You're the worst.
But, you know, I don't know. I just, my mom, she loved me. You know what I mean? She
no
did.
Doubt.
And
right.
she loved me. And she showed that in the future, how much she does love me. But at the time, I was questioning her love.
Gotcha. And that probably, you know, at 10 years old, being a kid, because I grew up, my parents got divorced as well. I remember the feeling mm-hmm. of, like, because I didn't want it to be like that. I wanted my parents to be together. I wanted my parents to, you know, like, I wanted to have a normal life, and I didn't.
Yeah, because back then, I mean, divorce wasn't as big as it was.
No, correct.
Now, you know, I mean, now it's, everyone gets divorced.
And that's all you've ever known. Do you remember maybe at one point, do you think your parents had a good relationship or bad? Like, outside of that, do you ever remember there being a lot of chaos at home?
No, and that's the thing. Like, it was a shocker to everybody.
Got you. So you were blindsided with it.
My mom and dad hardly ever fought, ever.
Or at least not in front of you.
Yeah, at least not in front of me where I seen it. So when this happened, it was like,
it's like out of nowhere.
Yeah, my dad was shocked. I was shocked. My sister was shocked. And just to see the pain my dad went through, kind of, it was sad. So,
dude, you know, it sucks that we have to bring up things that hurt us as kids, right? And then that one thing, I know a lot of children go through it. I know my kids have been hurt. I remember being hurt as a kid myself.
Yeah.
And now to meet another man that has experienced these things. And it's not unusual. It's not unusual for people's parents to get divorced, but it doesn't discount the fact that the children are really affected by it.
Absolutely.
And now everything's changing. And now you live with your dad. You see your mom. You said about a year afterwards, you start seeing her a bit more. And this man that she had cheated on, she get married to?
No, she never got married to
so
him.
So it was just like.
But she was with him for like 8 years, probably 7 years, 8 years.
And do you remember hating him growing up?
Yes.
So give me some, like, did you ever do anything like really mean to him or?
No, not really. We used to, well, he was an alcoholic.
Okay.
So when I'd go down my mom's house to visit, he was always drunk. He was an alcoholic to the point to where if he didn't have it, he was shaking and throwing up in bed.
Wow.
So there was bottles all over the house. He was staggering all over the place. And then, you know, once you get that drunk, you can get mean as well. So, I mean, he's never put his hands on me. He's never physically abused me, but I guess you can say we've gotten the arguments. We've right. gotten the almost fights, you know, because he's talking to my sister a certain way or he's talking to my mom a certain way because he's drunk. And, you know, and I was almost like the man in the family at my mom's house. And so I would stick up for them. And so I've got into it with them quite a few times as a child, 12, 13, 14 years old. You know, and my mom, I guess she wanted to be the cool mom. My mom, she was a partier, you know, and she liked to drink and she liked to smoke weed. She liked to do stuff like that. And I think after she found out I started drinking, I think she wanted to be the cool mom.
So she let it happen?
So she would let us drink at her house.
You couldn't do that at home, though, right? You couldn't do that with your dad.
Hell no.
Isn't that why? Okay, so this is a huge stark difference, right? So you're being raised mostly by your dad. Your dad's strict, but also, you know, you're rocking, keeping you involved in sports and encouraging you. And, you know, and he's in pain, though. I mean, you said yes. You recognize that. Your mom on the other side just wanted to party, right?
Yeah, that's basically what it was.
So she meets a guy probably at a bar or whatever, you know, another guy that, you know, that drinks a lot. He's abusive verbally, as you can see. Mm-hmm. And your mom kind of just let it happen.
Yeah.
You know, she didn't, you were sticking up for her. She probably would, at times would say, do you remember what that was like when you would stick up for like maybe your mom? Would she tell you, you know, don't, or would she encourage you to, I mean, do you remember any of that?
Yeah, she was always, my whole life, my mom's been on her boyfriend's side.
Gotcha.
It's always, I mean, there's been throughout my childhood, there's 6 months or so where I would just go without seeing my mom because she would always have her boyfriend side, and we'd be like, well, if you don't get rid of him, we ain't coming down to see you no more. And then it would be she picks him.
So that even does more damage to you.
Yes.
Really? I mean, and these are things that are kind of deep-seated, right? I mean, you talk about experiencing them, and you've just brought up that your mom was trying to be the cool mom. You know, this is into your how old were you when you started drinking?
The first time I drank, I was probably 12 years old.
Okay.
When I was a kid, I was real, I didn't like being center of attention, but I did, you know, okay. Like I didn't like to go up and stand up in front of the class and share my project or stuff like that. 'Cause I was so full of fear. I would rather just not even share it and take the F. Rather than to get up in front of the class.
Why do you think that was?
Self-centered fear.
Well, I mean, you can identify that now, right? Like you were afraid of what people would think about you.
Absolutely.
And you were worried for what reasons? Like, do you remember, like, as a kid? You know, like you said, you can only, and this is stuff, right? Like, you know, there has to be something. Like, I can remember being embarrassed at times because I felt, like, less than other people, right? I felt. And then, you know, it would go away. Sometimes it would come back, but it was always this thing like I felt different than everybody else. Yeah. And I felt like they were, you know, or I also had these really red lips, right? And I was embarrassed by them. And, you know, I started to get chunkier in middle school and I was embarrassed by that. So there's some, you know, some of those things. Like I thought people thought about me as much as I thought they did. Does that make sense? Like people don't really give a shit about you.
No.
They're thinking about themselves, and but kids are mean too. So, I mean, was there any, like, do you remember any experience where you were like the blunt of a joke or, you know, you say self-centered
really
fear, and that's a coverall, right?
Yeah.
It is. And I know that that's a recovery thing and you can identify that. But sometimes for me, that's not good enough. I have to look at why, what I was so afraid of at the time.
Well, you know, as a child, and you'll probably see throughout this, I've had a speech impediment also my whole life as far as I stuttered real bad when I was a kid.
Okay.
So I didn't really like to get up in front of the class for that simple reason. And
well, I don't think that's a simple reason. I think that that's something that would be hard to make okay. Like you, it was embarrassing.
Yeah,
I get that.
Everyone else was talking fine, and I go up there and I stutter throughout the
whole
thing.
Did you do like speech therapy and stuff?
No. My mom used to always ask the schools, like, does he need speech therapy? Does he need speech therapy? And they'd just be like, no, I think it's just something, like, they never put me in classes for.
You know, I have a guy that I work with here at Cumulus that had a really bad stutter his entire life. And he still, I believe, does. And I've heard his story. Rockin' Ron, who's awesome, he wouldn't mind me shouting him out. But he got into broadcasting because he could do that without the stutter. Like, one thing that he could focus on. And it was a big deal, and it still is. Yeah. And I understand, like, by knowing you, and look, I have a speech impediment at times. Mm-hmm. I do things, and I whether it's more noticeable or not is besides the point. But as a kid, it sucks because kids are going to make fun of you.
Yeah.
So you, and I'm not, look, I don't want, I have to bring these things up because I think that this is a real reason as to why you had self-centered fear and how that carried in and the moment you would drink or use, it would go away. I believe that you even said, like, you know, when I drank, all my problems went away. And this is probably a pretty big problem outside of the other stuff, right?
Absolutely.
So getting in front of class, speaking, having, you know, a stutter or trying to get things out, you'd rather just not do it at all. And I understand that. I appreciate you actually saying that. I think it's important because these things that affect us as children carry through into being an adult. And that lasts for a long time. Mm-hmm. It does. And now, you know, you're old enough, you're 31 years old. I'm sure that you find ways to just push through it. And just like, this is who I am. I can't help it.
I can't fix
so,
it.
Right. Yeah. If I could fix it, I would. And, but I appreciate you bringing that up. So now.
My dad, he didn't like to see me drunk. Like he did not want to see me drunk whatsoever. He didn't want to see me high. He didn't want to see me drunk because he hated to see his son that way. Because, you know, my dad is a young adult, and he struggled with his own demons.
Which we all do, right, to some degree.
But he's different than me, you know. Once he had kids, he stopped it all.
Gotcha.
Like, he drank on the weekends when he went out with his friends. But other than that,
he put it away. My dad did the same thing.
Yeah, like, I got kids now, I got to stop. And he stopped.
Right. He grew up.
I don't have that choice of doing
You're
that.
Just like, this is part of who I am. Yeah. And I get that, being in recovery and identifying that there's somehow, you know, we respond differently to drugs and alcohol. And it's always important to bring up the past. And we're not going to sit here forever, right? We're not going to just talk about, okay, we have identified parents divorced, dealing with a speech impediment, you know, having self-centered fear, wanting to fit in, thinking, you know, like, we've talked about these things. And I'm curious now, because here you're trying to play sports and you're drinking and using. And did you do that throughout?
No. By the time I was a freshman in high school, I was 14 years old at the time. And by that time, I quit all sports.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that.
Yeah. Drinking and doing drugs got way more important than anything in life, really. More important than a relationship with my family. More important than school, more important than sports. If it didn't involve getting drunk or getting high, I didn't want to do it. Of course, we go to parties and high school parties and stuff like that. And then we had another other friend's house. His uncle, he lived with his uncle, and his uncle worked third shift. So we were freshmen in high school. And
right.
His uncle would leave for work at 11 a.m., not come back till 8 a.m. or 11 p.m.
So you could just kick it there, right?
Yeah, and we drink and have girls over and smoke weed and do whatever.
I think a lot of this, like, it's hard for me to imagine now that I have children, because my oldest will be 14 in a month, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she is not developed. Her brain is not developed. She is still a very much a child.
Absolutely.
And to think that at her age, people are drinking and using, I mean, it blows me away. Like, I can't, and maybe that's just trying to assume the best of my children, but I just can't fathom the idea of her being drunk.
I look at kids like in high school now.
Like,
and I'm
what
just
are
like,
you talking
God,
about?
When I was their age, I was doing cocaine.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, that's the thing. So we're going to pick it up a bit then. So now you're not playing sports. You're in high school. Oak Hills. Are your grades shitty or what?
My ninth grade year, I got kicked out of Oak Hills.
Why'd you get kicked out? We got to talk about that.
I come into school high. I would come into school loaded. I wouldn't come to school at all.
Right.
I would get kicked out of classes. My ninth grade year, first, second, third, and fourth quarter, I got straight F's in every single class.
Damn.
Even gym.
F in gym.
Because I wouldn't even dress for gym.
Right.
Because I was high, and I was like, I ain't ruining
I'm
my
not
buzz.
Doing this. Yeah. Right, exactly.
Run the mile? I don't think so.
I was actually held back. I had failed. I went to Walnut Hills and did so poorly there because I never wanted to show up. I was more concerned with drinking and using that I was held back a year, and I was sent to a Baptist school, which was a culture shock to me. And I've talked about it in other episodes. So I know the feel like just that was a huge blow to my ego. Right. And mm-hmm. One of the first time I've suffered any consequences as a result of doing really what I wanted to do. Fortunately, I was able to figure out a way to graduate on time by the time, you know, I credit hours and all these things. Should I have been held back a year? Probably. I should have really just, you know, experienced it and buckled down and just dealt with the fact that I did really terrible in school that year. But I wanted to find a way for my own ego to get out of school on time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget that because I was the one who figured it out. I figured it out. I felt like, really, you know, I could have been in the normal grade, but you guys are holding me back to be assholes. I remember having that mentality, but so did you, if you failed ninth grade, were you held back then?
I had to go to it was an alternative school that you only went 3 hours a day, and it was for basically the bad kids.
Okay.
And they wanted me to get my ninth and 10th grade year done all in 1 year, which was like, I had to do all the ninth grade courses on the computer. Then I had to do all the 10th grade courses on the computer. But, you know, me, I find a way to cheat. And
I like I said, me, I find a way to cheat. Yeah.
And so what it was is we would do all of our work on a computer, and to pass the test, the teacher would have to put in a password. And then if you get this password, you get the answers. They're all
right. The answer key. Gotcha.
So what we did is we would watch them put in the password, even though we weren't supposed to. And then we would get the password, and I just go through every test and get all the answers.
And that way you'd memorize them and put them.
No, I'd write them all down.
Oh, okay. All right. Damn, dude.
And then I passed the 9th and 10th grade in 1 year because I cheated my way through.
So you. Well, I mean, it's pretty ingenious of you. I mean, it's not right. I mean, you can identify that. But at the time, I bet you felt pretty cool. Did you share those answers with any of the other kids?
Oh, yeah. There's like a whole group of us that used to do it.
Well, thankfully, one just you. Like, you were sharing the love of trying to get through. What was your dad like through all this? Because if you're having problems and you said your dad was really involved in your life, was he just like he didn't know what to do, that you were just out of control or what? Do you remember?
I think my dad was in denial more than anything.
Okay. Not my boy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Kind of. He knew, though. He knew. And, but he was always there for me. Regardless, because I was his son, he never gave up on me. You know, he never turned his back on me and said, I'm done with you.
He just kept involved.
It was getting to that point at the end, of course.
So now let's get through high school. I also remember you just saying a couple minutes ago about doing cocaine in high school.
Yes.
So do you remember that first experience and how that was introduced or what? Or no?
The first experience.
If you're doing
first
cocaine.
First time I did cocaine, I was like, I had to be in 10th grade. And how we did it. I used to hang out with these skateboarder kids because these skateboarder kids had all the cool drugs,
Right.
They like acid. They like mushrooms. They like cocaine. And I was 10th grade. I'm like, shit, I want to try all this.
10th grade.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, I want to try all this, And so they went to my school, of course, for the bad kids.
Right. So they're already there
there. And after school one day, I had my license at the time because I got my license when I was 16 years old. But from 16 on, I drove drunk and high all the time.
Dude, you're lucky. I mean, you didn't get in trouble or anything?
I got one DUI in 2012. This was back in like 2004. 2003. So I went a long time without
getting really in trouble.
Yeah, for driving. And I used to drive drunk and high every single day.
So all through high school, and then you used to get cocaine from the skater kids that went to your vocational school,
yeah.
I guess you could say. And
all right. The first time, the skater kids actually put cocaine in a joint.
Right, like a primo, call, right?
And that was like the first time I ever experienced cocaine ever. Which, I don't know. I really didn't care for it at that time because I don't like the.
No, I get that. Because that's a weird thing. Like, the mixing marijuana and cocaine is a terrible feeling, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It's just a.
It's awful.
I even felt the same way about drinking and smoking together would make me feel way fucked up, right?
Yeah, room spinning.
Every single time. And now, all right, so that's high school and you're. I'm guessing you get through high school though.
Yeah, I went to Diamond Oaks Vocational School in 11th grade after I caught back up in that one school. And Diamond Oaks is a school for guys just like us, man. And there's so much drugs there, so much. I mean, I was in heaven, And once again, I got kicked out of there as well. And I went back to that other school because I know I could pass because I could steal the password. So what I did is I went back to that school and I stole the password and I graduated in 6 months.
Oh, wow.
Because I cheated my way through.
So you basically cheated your way all through high school.
Yes.
Is what you're saying.
Yes.
And I appreciate you actually saying that because you I mean, we find a way to survive, don't we? Yeah. I mean, and that you know, you said that you shared this with the other kids in your class and around all the people that you wanted to be around who are partying just like you. Your mom's not holding you accountable in any way. She's just letting you drink and use there. And your dad, who's, you know, you said just didn't want to believe it, was in denial. And now you're finally getting out of high school on a lie, but you're out.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you do that first year?
The first year, you know, my dad had a business my whole life, a trucking business, semi-trucks. And so really my whole life I was told that I'm going to work for him and
right.
that I get the
family business.
I get it when he retires. And so my whole life I never worried about a job. I never worried about.
Because you always had a safety net.
Yes. And I always was like, I'm not going to college. I'm not. Screw school. I'm not even trying in school.
You know, I can't cheat my way through college.
Yeah, and I'm just like, I'm just going to work for my dad. And literally the year I graduated, one of his truck drivers killed an old lady and old man on the AA highway in Kentucky. And his company got sued, and he lost his business.
Oh, shit.
So then it was I didn't know what I was going to do, you know. My first year out of school, I kind of had I tried to work, you know, and but once again, drinking and getting high was more important than a job.
Yeah, so, right. I mean, it's been like this whole tragedy to triumph is not because your life has been fantastic. It always has been. But you have a pattern here of one. You know, that's really been identified, and now even getting out of school and thinking you had something lined up anyway, and now it doesn't work out,
yeah.
which for situations way out of your control, was that just like a disappointing day, or were you like pissed because now you can't do this at all and you have no idea what you're going to do?
I was pretty much pissed and I had no idea what I was going to do.
So you're like, I know, and probably just drinking and using and trying other things. Yeah. Were you like experimenting with, LSD or
I was experimenting when I graduated high school. I started experimenting with like ecstasy.
Okay,
we got on ecstasy real bad there for a while. Cocaine still. Xanax. I loved Xanax. That was probably
those
favorite.
Probably like all your problems really went away when you took that.
I started. And then when I was about 15 years old.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I think that's important. To think.
Yeah.
So you're doing all sorts of different things, but those was your favorite, Xanax.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. When you were drinking, did you ever drink gin?
Sometimes.
What do you think? That shit's disgusting. Like, what do you think about it? I think it's terrible. It's like rubbing alcohol.
Yeah, it's terrible.
All right, good. See, another person thinks gin is gross. Just FYI.
Yeah,
terrible. Okay, so popping pills, all these other things. Like, this is all the drug use, and not just a substance to substance, but overall, you're doing it all.
Yes. I don't
pills,
have a drug
weed,
of choice.
Drinking.
I don't have a, yeah. I'll drink whatever you got, except gin.
Exception. See, that's the truth, isn't it? No, so that's important to kind of detail. You're out of school now. You don't have any job prospects. All you really still care about is getting high.
Yes.
And you're on. Were you prescribed Xanax, or
no,
was it just
buying them
on the streets?
Them off the streets.
Okay. So, right. Were you ever prescribed anything at this time?
At that time, no, I was not.
All right. So, but at one point in your life, you were.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So. What happens that kind of bring you to where you're starting to be prescribed something?
All right.
Or is there anything important from like the ages of 18 to?
18 to 21, I was in bars. I got a fake ID. I was in bars every single night doing the same drugs that we just discussed. And kind of just living wild. It wasn't like
life's a party.
Yeah, it wasn't like I was looking for a career or a job.
No.
I couldn't hold a job. I couldn't keep a job. I would always get fired within the couple
what are some
months.
Of the jobs you've had during that time, do you remember?
Warehouse jobs through temp services.
Just bullshit jobs.
Yeah, and I get fired through a temp service. That's how bad I was.
You're just never showing up.
Yeah,
or you're showing
I just
want to
show
right?
up or... I do no call, no shows because I would be like, oh, you know what? I'm going to go out with my friends tonight. I'm going to be home by midnight. I'm going to go to work. And I want to show up. I want to get home till 5 a.m.
Right. And you're like, I'm just screw it. I ain't going.
And in that time, I had to figure out a way to make money. And because it was never like I need to quit getting drunk and high and get a job. It was like, how can I get drunk and high and make money? And, you know, at this time when I was 18 years old, I gravitated towards Price Hill, you know.
Which, for people who aren't from Cincinnati, Price Hill is what? What's the best way to explain it?
A shithole.
Right. You know, it's like
a disease in itself.
Right. Like, you know, people from, like, not to dog anybody that's really from Price Hill, because there's some great people from Price Hill, but it's just anything, it's anything.
Anything goes.
Anything goes, right. Kind of like our Cincinnati Sin City.
Yeah, and it's kind of like...
red light district, drugs.
Any drugs you want. The type of bars I like, which are hole-in-the-wall bars where you can do drugs in the
bathroom. Lower income, and that's to be expected, too. And, you know, Section 8 housing, drugs are everywhere, drug dealers, prostitutes, all of it. Yeah. That whole, if you want it, to find an area to do the craziest shit possible, go to Price Hill, Ohio. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, so now you're there and you are going to start selling drugs, it sounds
like. And I started to hang out with these guys in high school a little bit. And,
the skater guys?
These are the Price Hill guys.
Okay.
I started to hang out with them in the last couple of years of high school and, you know, we all got out of school, and I was trying to work, and then they were selling cocaine and selling weed and drinking all day and doing drugs all day and had money and had girls and had power.
Right.
Really what it was.
And you're like, I want that.
And I was like, that's what I want to do. I was addicted to that street lifestyle more, just as much as I was the drugs and alcohol. I love the fast life. I love the adrenaline that comes with
exciting.
It.
It's exciting. I get that.
You never know what's going to happen.
And you've really never done anything
basis anyway. Yeah.
So let's just be real. Like, I mean, you even talked about playing sports, but it's not something you continued to do.
No.
And your life centered around drugs and alcohol. And now, in order to support your habit, you said, fuck it, I'm going to sell them too.
Absolutely.
And that's what you did. So selling cocaine?
Yes.
Like, how much weight?
Marijuana. Like, I was never...
Not like some big level top tier baller or anything, but you were doing enough to support your habit.
I was doing enough to make enough money to survive and to support my habit. Okay. I was never a brick boy or, you know what I mean?
Right. Like, so what was that like, though? Like, I've tried to sell drugs. I was never really good at it because I liked them too much. But, you know, what did it feel like being, you know, from the ages of 18, 21 here we're talking about this time? What did that make you feel like? You said power. There was a sense of power with that. And
always a sense of power and control because
people need you.
Yeah, you got what people want. And then also you got a big old bag of cocaine, so you can pretty much get any girl you want.
Right.
You know, especially if she does cocaine. So, you know, it was just like, it was that lifestyle, man. And, after a while, I fell in love with it, and I really, 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 really thought that was what I was going to do for the rest of my life.
Even though odds are dictate that you can't be a successful drug dealer.
Correct.
At the time, you were like, it's not going to happen to me type shit.
And you know what comes with that life is jail. What comes with that life is prison. And at this point, I was willing to accept that. My friends were going there. I thought that just was part of the lifestyle.
You're good. I mean, these are the type of people you're hanging out with. This is what it is. And plus, you're fueled by drugs and attention and women and money and all that other shit that goes with it. Price Hill, Ohio, as we're talking about. Anything goes there. And do you get in trouble?
When I was 20 years old, I had consequences before this, but nothing serious. Possession of marijuana, paraphernalia, get caught with a bowl or something like that.
Yeah, silly stuff, like ticketable offenses.
Yeah. Okay. And so I never really got into big trouble yet. When I was 20 years old, I just got back from Miami, Florida, because I went down there on a spring break vacation. And I came back and I was drunk and high on ecstasy and clonopins, and I was driving in Clifton. And I was going up to a bar on Short Vine. I can't remember the name of it. I was messed up. And I got pulled over by a police officer, and they were actually like undercover police officers. And they pulled me out of my car, and this was the time when I'd never done it, but the guy I went to Miami, Florida with sold heroin. Okay. And he gave me a little bit to try to sell, because I was like, I'll try to sell it. This was back before it was even big in Cincinnati, like it is today, right. Of course. This was 2008. And I got caught with a little bit of that, and I got caught with 3.5 grams of cocaine and a 1/4 pound of weed. And
you're riding dirty. Right. Yeah. You're lying. You're messed up. Like, this drunk, just goes, I mean, yeah, drunk, high,
driving out of your mind, like driving that. Around.
And now you're getting caught with a lot of weight. You've never really been in trouble. You've had little slaps on the wrist, yeah, and this and that.
And I was 20 years old, and I went to jail. I don't really remember. I was blacked out the whole time. And I woke up in jail, and I didn't even know what I was in jail for.
Oh, shit.
I had no clue. So when I asked the guard, and they kind of explained to me what I was there for, I was kind of in shock. But I figured, because I knew I had that stuff on me, but by the time this all happened, I was blacked out.
Okay.
So I went to court for that, and, you know, they tried to offer me drug court. They tried to offer me River City, and the way I look back on it now is I just wasn't ready for treatment.
No, I mean, and also you just, with the lifestyle, too, that I'm not an addict, I'm trying to put myself in your headspace at the time, because you're kind of glazing over things, and that's fine to move the story along. Right, because we're just identified. You are doing what you want. You sell drugs. Now you've gotten in trouble selling them, and they're trying to give you help, and you're not taking it.
Correct.
So you're like, I'd rather just do my time.
Yes.
Because of the people that you're kicking it with, said, dude, just do your time type shit.
Yeah, because I'm listening to these guys from Price Hill, and I'm listening to these guys in jail that are just saying, like, you won't walk probation. You won't do it. You might as well just take your time. And really, I mean, at that point in time, they were probably right.
Yeah. You know, no, you're right. I get that.
I couldn't stop because I got out on OR bond and on house arrest. And the day I got out, I started drinking and getting high again.
Right. Like, that's not going to stop me.
Yeah. And it didn't. And so I was going to court for that. And in the meantime, how I got prescribed the medication, when I was 21 years old, I had a lot of pain going on, and I never really dealt with opiate pain pills.
Right.
I did them here and there on the weekends if I was drunk and took some Percocets.
Just was never really a thing. You like Xanax, you like cocaine, you like weed, but you didn't really mess with this.
No.
Okay.
And
you're out of jail, though. You're not in, like, this is just something that's continuing?
Yes.
Okay.
And so I started having a lot of pain, and I was going to the hospital a lot, trying to figure out what was wrong with me, and come to find out, I was 21 years old, and I had a tumor on my spine the size of a Nerf football.
Oh, wow.
They did
like a Nerf, we're talking
12 centimeters in diameter.
This is on your spine?
Yes.
Your lower back?
My lower back.
Shit. How did you not notice that, by the way?
I did. At the end, I could feel it.
Okay.
I could feel it in my leg, and it actually paralyzed me at the end to where I could barely even walk.
So, okay, well, it's not – I want to find it. So you are in pain. You are going to the doctor to find out, like, you're like, look, I don't know what's going on with my back. I just know something's not right. Come to find out you got a tumor on your back the size of a Nerf football.
Yes.
And what – they just tell you that and you send you home or what?
No. I had to stay in the hospital for 3 days, and they were feeding me tons of Percocets in the hospital. They scheduled a biopsy. They did that, and they called me back a few days later and told me it was cancer. And I was 21, and my grandma died in 2006 from cancer. So the first thing I thought was that I was going to die.
Right.
I didn't know how to deal with it.
Well, who does? You're 21 years old, and they're telling you have cancer.
Yeah, that was the last thing I thought it was.
Why don't we let's push away all this other stuff, right? Let's push away your past and all of these things. In this moment, none of that shit really matters, right? Doesn't matter that you got caught with drugs. Doesn't matter. Like, you're in front of a doctor, and you're being faced with a situation that you're going to die at a young age, too. And all the thoughts, like, what type of thoughts go through your head? Do you remember? I mean, I'm sure you've, like, you know.
Sad, crying a lot. I would sit at home and cry.
You're like, I'm fucked.
Yeah, full of
fear. My grandma's dead. She died of this. Which, as your family, I'm guessing they're being supportive.
Oh,
but
yeah,
they're all, you
absolutely,
know, we're going to get through this. And you're just like, it's cancer in my back, and it's the size of a football.
Yeah.
And it's touching your spine. And so it's like a weird plate, like, you know.
It's laying on my sciatic nerve. So I was having a lot of damage in my right leg to where I couldn't even really walk that well.
And so they prescribed you pain medication. You said overwhelmed with fear. I would be too. Let's make that very clear. If the doctor tells you you have cancer, that's I don't care how good of the cancer it is.
it's
fucking
cancer.
And you're young, and now they're giving you pain medication. You need it. Let's just be like, because of the amount of pain, and it's affecting your sciatic nerve.
At the beginning, I needed it.
I'm just saying, that's why we're saying in this moment. Mm-hmm. So you have this stuff prescribed to you, Percocet, immediately for the pain. It's helping.
Yes.
Right? And the thing with pain medication, not only, I mean, it blocks the signals in your brain, releases dopamine. This is what it does. Like, so it doesn't fix the issue. It just convinces you it's not happening.
Correct. It's
okay.
Temporary. And at that time, I was getting prescribed 360 Percocet 10s every 2 weeks.
Holy, that's 360?
Yes.
2009, 2008?
2008.
That's a shitload of Percocet.
Yeah, so that's
360, that's 720 a month.
Yes.
How many are you supposed to be taking? Why are they doing, why give you 10? Okay, it's beyond me how they would do that.
Beyond me as well.
Like,
and the doctor even told me, my surgeon told me, he said, take as many as you need, is what he told me.
At 21 years old.
At 21 years. And for a drug addict.
You're like, okay.
I'm like, deal. And so.
That's hard to believe to me.
I would take them all, and I'd call him back in 2 weeks and tell him I need more. And he'd just write me another script.
Well, you
for
have
more.
Cancer, though, too.
Yeah.
Like, I guess,
I mean,
you know.
And I had a tumor on my spine that was humongous. And, I really was in pain, but I was also abusing them as well.
You can't take 360 Percocets in 2 weeks and not get addicted.
Yeah.
Nobody can. Nobody can. That's a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, even if it's like you don't have a life run by, you know, addiction, that many Percocets or 700 in a month, 720, will have any human being addicted to them.
Absolutely.
And you're getting this on a consistent basis. And now is the tumor not going anywhere? So let's talk about this. This is what I think is important to your story. Not all that other stuff. Look, coming of age, doing dumb shit. Now you're faced with cancer at a young age. You're on pain medication. Your whole life is changing now.
Yes. It changed for 4 years. I had surgery at UC Hospital, a 14-hour surgery. I was in ICU for almost a week afterwards. They removed the tumor, and they actually had to remove a nerve out of my back to get the tumor out, and which left me with permanent sciatic nerve damage in my right leg. I had to learn how to walk again.
Oh, my God.
I had to learn how to walk again. I walked with a walker for a while. I walked with a cane for a while. And I had to go to Children's Hospital because that's where they were going to do my chemotherapy at, and that's where my oncologist was at. So I went over there, and they set it up, and I had to do 7-8 treatments of chemotherapy, where I would come in on a Thursday and stay till Sunday night, and I had to sit in the hospital bed and get the drip of IV of.
And you can't be around people. Like, this is when people get chemotherapy in that sense, like, you can't have outside contact, right?
I can,
but it's very minimal. They have to really wash themselves.
Yeah, but just my immune system's,
shot. It's gone.
It's gone. I got to be real careful about people that are sick or even have a cold.
Yeah,
because I can easily get it because I have nothing to fight off. Because once the chemotherapy goes in your body, it don't just kill the cancer cells. It kills everything in your body.
And you've learned a lot. Like, look, I'm not going to act like I've been exposed to family members that have had cancer and some friends, including yourself, you know. And I knew before talking to you that this was a part of your story, and I've never heard it. And it's actually really heavy to me at the moment, right? It's really heavy because you're young and, you know, you're on not just the medication, but the course of treatment that's involved in that, and having and still being afraid. Like, I could see that dominated your whole being for such a long time and not looking good. Like, I mean, which is besides the point, but, like, you know.
I lost all my hair. I really didn't like to go out. Because I
not
didn't
only
want
like
people to see me.
I'm not trying to be funny, but like the speech impediment and cancer together, you're just like, what the fuck? Like, really? Like, I mean, can I?
And I always wore a hat, but like I lost my eyebrows. I lost my arm hair. I lost every hair on my body was gone.
And you're on medication though too, right? Like,
Like
that you said for
my
4 years. Like
surgery. I got prescribed Oxycontins. I was on Oxycontins for a couple of years. I was prescribed 180 Perc 15s a month.
Percocet 15 milligrams. Yes. Right. So you're on just a hell of a lot of medication.
Yes. And this gives me a justification to do them.
Yeah, because you also say, yeah, I have cancer there
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I have cancer and I need these.
Were you selling them too?
Yes.
Well, that's an important part of it. Yes. So that really hasn't changed at all.
No, my behaviors still have
okay. So you're
changed.
Still all right. All right. So you really never stopped being a drug dealer. Now you have instead of having to meet up with somebody to get their thing, like your doctor
is going, doctor,
and you're taking enough for yourself and then selling them as well, taking them every single
what
day.
And
you have more than any one human needs anyway.
Absolutely,
which is hard to imagine, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like looking back at it, you're like, what would compel any doctor to say that that's okay? Seriously.
Yeah. 21 years old.
21 years of 21 to 25, right? You said 4 years this went on.
I went through cancer for that amount of time, but pain pills went on until I got sober.
Okay. So that's what I'm trying to make sure because we're jumping around a little bit. I want to kind of, so 21, you get diagnosed. 4 years long, you're getting treatment for it.
Well, what happened is 21, I got diagnosed. I did 7-8 months of chemotherapy. Six,
off the bat.
Yeah.
Okay.
6 treatments of radiation. And after that, they said that I was in remission. And they said it was gone. And so I was in remission. And at this time, I will say that my mom was with me through this whole thing.
Cool. Well, she always loved her son.
Yeah, she let me live with her. She went to every doctor's appointment with me, every chemotherapy treatment. She was there all weekend, and I'm truly grateful for that. But so then I was in remission again, and once I get in remission, I do what I do best. And my mom took care of me for them 8 months, and I ran back out of her house, and I was prescribed pain pills now because the sciatic nerve damage in my leg and all this nerve damage in my leg, I could go to pretty much any doctor and get anything I wanted.
Right.
Especially in 2008, 2009. So I was getting prescribed Oxycontins and Percocets, and I would get them and I'd go out and sell them and I'd go get the stronger ones for me and then I'd sell them. Like, I was always willing and dealing.
And you're avoiding prison too. Like, the you had already gotten in trouble.
Yeah.
Like, but because you need active treatment, was that keeping you out?
Yeah, because I found out I had cancer right before I got sentenced for my case. And because I had to do chemotherapy, because I had all these things I had to do, they put me on felony probation.
Okay.
Which I didn't have. And then she knew I was on all them pain medications.
Yeah, you're like, right. You really were avoiding. You did. Okay. That's, I think it's important to say. And look, sometimes I'm better at doing this chronologically, like 21, this, da, 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 that. But I need to circle back around to make sure that what's going on in your life. So you're on pain medication. You've gotten treatment. You're avoiding jail time. You have a free pass to use pain medication. You're on felony reporting paper, but it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. So you're really just doing pain medication?
No. No.
Well, why would you be? Yeah. Right. What else were you doing? You're still taking the Klonopin and Xanax and things like that, too?
Yeah, I was taking benzos as well.
Drinking still? Or not really?
During chemotherapy, no.
Because I was going to say, all right, if you were, you're a savage, okay?
Because when I was doing chemotherapy, I couldn't even, I'd be in bed, I'd throw up for a week. My bones would hurt for a week. Really, I was bedridden for about 8 months. I laid in bed so much I got a bed sore the size of a softball, you know. I just laid around, really.
So you had a tumor the size of a Nerf ball, now a bed sore the size of a softball.
Yeah.
And, I like your sports analogies.
I was like 20. Well, the doctor told me the size of a Nerf football.
Right.
But, so I just laid around, man, and really I felt sorry for myself.
Well, yeah, I would too, though. I mean, I'm not going to lie and act like
pity.
How could you not? And plus the pain medication, of all these things, you haven't really done anything with your life either.
No.
So you have that and you can't physically do it. So I would have to imagine the like how things bounce around in my own head sober, how what they're like during a very heavy time, untreated addiction, really. You're just having a full pass to do it all. I mean, it's really, you're lucky that you made it out of this and that we can have this conversation today because, I mean, I don't know if I'd ever really given up, but I would feel as though there are many times that you just wanted to give up.
Oh, so I gave up for a long time because in 2011, I went back to the doctor and, so I had to go do scans every 3 months and every 6 months and then every year.
And you've avoided prison this whole time.
Yes.
Because of your treatment needs. And are you off felony paper by this time or no? Or
I got sentenced to 2 years felony probation. I did not have to report to her. I did not have to do no work detail. I didn't have to do no classes. I didn't have to even take drug tests. Because she said, just get better.
Right.
Because I was going through all this
other stuff.
These other things. And after a year, I paid off all my fines, of course.
Yeah, you had the money.
Yeah, and I paid off all my fines. And on Christmas Day, it was like the day before or after Christmas, she called me up and said, Kyle, because I called her and I let her know that I was done with treatment for my cancer and stuff.
Right.
And she was like, well, Kyle, she said, Merry Christmas. We're letting you off of felony paper. Come down and sign the papers. And I'm like, all right. And I went down there and signed the papers, and I got off probation. Never even had to take a drug test.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, so, still no real consequences outside of the fact that you have personal issues. Cancer is a terrible thing. I don't care if you're a drug addict or not. It's terrible.
Yes.
And you're getting the treatment. You're still using. Now you said in 2011, you had to do scans every so often to make sure that it hasn't come back.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens in 2011?
2011, I went to the doctor and I did my scans the day before because we used to go the day before to do scans and go back the next day to get the results and get the follow-up. And I don't know, man. Before I even went, I had a bad feeling. I don't know. It's almost like your body tells you
something
before.
Right.
Yeah, that something's not right. And I went in there, and he set us down again, and he let me know that the cancer has came back. And at this time, I was 23 years old, and that's pretty much when I just gave up. You know, I gave up on everything. And I remember vividly that I ran out of the hospital. Well, I didn't run, but I walked out of the hospital, stormed out into the parking garage, and I just sat down in the parking garage and just cried.
Yeah. Because you had just been through so much.
Yeah, right? I mean, I just went through all this stuff. I was in remission for, I believe, a year and a half at the time. So, you know, at that point, I was starting to feel better. Right. And I was starting to look normal again. And it came back. And that was the last thing I wanted to hear. And I ran out of the doctor's office, and I just sat down in the garage and just cried. I had to have surgery again at Children's Hospital. This time it was all done there because that's where my oncologist was at.
Right.
So my surgery was done at Children's Hospital. So I did that there, and I did that, and then I had to do chemotherapy again. And but this time they started coming out with like oral pills that you could take for chemotherapy.
Okay, instead of,
and it's for when the tumor is not as aggressive. Like, of course, if it's a very aggressive,
then you have to get the IV.
You got to get the IV.
But they caught it beforehand.
Yes,
and they removed it, and now you're on oral.
They removed it, and they let me know that it was the same tumor as before. So since it's the same tumor as before, it was something that they probably missed the first time.
Gotcha,
that grew back. So they didn't want me to do the drip and all that again, because once again, I mean, it's very rough on your body. I mean,
yeah,
it's terrible on your heart and everything. And so they said, we're going to do this oral medication. I did the oral medication for about 7 months. Throughout this time, still getting pain medication.
Well, yeah.
Still getting pain medication. And through this time, my hair turned, this medication didn't make me go bald. It made my hair turn white.
The silver fox.
Yeah,
over
so
here.
Now I was a silver fox.
Yeah, and, you look like powder, right? Yeah. You're probably super pale.
I even got a picture in my phone, and I'll show you.
But yeah,
I was pale. You could just tell I was sick.
Right,
you know, I was very sick, and I went through this for 8 months. I was taking these medications, and finally, I went back to the doctor because I was only supposed to take it for 6. And the doctor was like, well, we want you to take it for a year now. And I refused it. I said, I'm done.
I can't do this to myself anymore.
I'm done. I've done it for 6. You told me 6 months. I did it for 8 months. And now you're telling me a year. And I said, I'm just done. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen. You know?
Right. So what's it like? Right. What's that feeling like being on that like, was it that terrible? Right.
The medication was, I was just tired all the time. I didn't have no, like, my mom got married.
And you couldn't even really go.
I was supposed to dance with her on a song that I didn't even know. It was supposed to be like a surprise where we danced or whatever. And I was over at her house. And I couldn't even get out of bed to go.
Right. So it just like, if this is what your life was going to be, it wasn't worth living, is what you're saying.
Yeah. And I just,
well, Kyle, I mean, I think it's important to say these things outside of the drugs, right?
Yeah.
Cause those have remained in there, but this is seriously tragic shit. This is terrible. You're young. You know, you went through chemotherapy and then you know, got rid of the cancerous tumor in your back, and were in remission for a bit, and then it comes back, and now you're on this medication instead, and your hair's turning white, you have no energy, you're pumped through full of pain medication, you're not really doing anything outside of that. So I can see you saying, fuck this.
Yeah.
Like, this is not what, like, if I'm supposed to die, like, let me die. Yeah. Like, this is,
this is life. I don't want to live.
Right. And I don't blame you. I don't think that anybody would blame you, like, thinking like that. And you tell your doctor and says, nope, I'm not doing it. So does it say fine? Like, that's your choice,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's absolutely my choice. And he said, well, that's fine. If you want to stop, we can stop and we can just start doing the scans again every 3 months, every 6 months, every year.
Right.
And so that's what I did. And but, you know, once that ended, I still had this opiate addiction.
Yeah, that doesn't get right.
That ain't going away. And eventually, I was getting my pain medication from Children's Hospital, the Oxycontins, the Percocets,
right,
through their pain management there.
Filled there, right.
Yeah. And they were trying to taper me down off of my medications. And, of course, me, I got to cuss the doctors out because they're trying to take what's making me feel good.
Right.
I walked out. And that's when I began to doctor shop. That's when I started going to every pain clinic. I'd stay in one for a while, you know, and then you got to take drug tests and you got to do this. And I would fail a drug test I've been kicked out of so many pain clinics. It's ridiculous. But I continued to get prescribed these medications for years. And, but you know, there comes a time where, the Oxycontins turned into OPs.
Which is Opana?
No. Remember, they were like...
Oh, yeah, that's right. So they changed...
Up.
That's correct. I was going to just say, so Oxycontin for a long time were able to be crushed and then snorted. And that's how you were using them, I'm guessing,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And then it came a point where the company that manufactured them added a substance in which if you tried to crush, they wouldn't crush. They actually gelled up under moisture.
Yes.
So they had to be swallowed.
Correct.
Okay, so. So
when that came about, you know, that's when heroin started getting real big in Cincinnati.
And you had even tried to sell it many years ago.
Yeah.
Had any need for it.
No.
Now we're talking it's 2012?
About
roughly?
2011, 2012.
Heroin is everywhere. You can't get your medications or you can't get the ones you want.
Yes.
And you're still being prescribed.
And I'm still getting kicked out of pain clinics,
right,
and having to deal with all this craziness. At this point in time, it's me.
But you're addicted. I mean, look, yes, you have a history of drug abuse. I'm not going to skirt the issue there. Like, we know that.
Yes,
we're in recovery. You have to identify it. But that shit changed dramatically when you got sick and
yeah,
that you were given these, like, an unlimited supply.
It's a whole nother beast, man.
Yeah, no doubt. It changes the brain.
Yeah. It's a whole nother beast.
So now they're gone. Now they're like, you can't get a doctor, which is kind of messed up to me that doctors will prescribe so many of them and say, you know what, you're taking too many. And this happens to a lot of other people,
yeah,
not just addicts, not just people who identify as in recovery. Like, we're talking most adults have experienced this because they're getting pressure. They should have never given you that many to begin with.
Correct.
Unfortunately, now look, I mean, you're not telling their story. But when you told me that right off the rip, 360 every 2 weeks is in such an insane amount. It's way more than you needed.
It was.
And to say now all of a sudden, oh, we're going to taper you down. We're going to get, after you've been on for years. Like, what are you, like, it doesn't work like that.
No.
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately, I don't think doctors knew.
How bad it really
even
was.
Even at the time of 2008, how addictive.
No, I believe that. I believe now they have that. Now. Which makes it even more fucked up when you hear about these doctors that have been doing this shit and prescribing people
prescribing,
anyway and
prescribing,
you know, pulling random ass teeth out of their mouths so they can get, like, unreal shit. So now you're going on the streets to get heroin because you can't. Like, it just was a natural thing? Was it just like, well, fuck it, I can't get these, and I know people who have heroin.
Yeah, I was like, I can't get these, and my one friend was there, and he did it.
Right.
And he's like, well, I can get you some of this, and makes you feel the same exact way as Oxycontins.
Gotcha.
And I was about to get sick, you know, because at this time, of course, if I don't have Oxycontins, I'm withdrawing.
Right.
And I started to feel it, and I was like, fuck it.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Give me some. If I'm not sick, then that's all that matters.
Right.
And I tried it, man, and I tried it, and I fell in love with it. From that day forward, that's all I wanted to do. I didn't want pain pills no more. Only thing I wanted was that. And, you know, when you start doing that, you start doing things that you said you would never, ever, ever, ever do. You know, I started stealing copper. I started stealing anything I could. I'd rip my friends off. And at the end, it got as bad as I started carrying a gun because I was... If I had to, I would rob somebody to get my Medicaid.
Have you robbed? I mean, like, that's part of your story?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not proud of it.
No, and as you shouldn't be. Like, that's the thing. I mean.
But that's where addiction takes me. And even today, when I look back at it, it's just like, I can't believe that was me.
No, I get that.
You know, I can't believe that was me. And that's what shows me also that even guys that are in prison for crazy things as far as aggravated robbery or home invasions. Most of them are sick.
Yeah. Know? Most of them are drug addicts.
Or
mental illness and all
those
other things.
Just like me, that if they're not on drugs, they're actually a pretty decent guy. You know?
And most people.
Yeah. Most. Exists.
Right. Most people. Some people I think are intrinsically evil.
Yeah.
But
yeah, there's always the ones.
Well, just to, because it doesn't go uphill or, you know, like it's all the same shit. I think it was important to talk about that. You're a cancer survivor, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And you've been in remission for how long?
9 years.
9 years. Amazing. Really is. And that you, said, I'm not taking this stuff anymore. And, you know, your life, it got worse, but then it got better.
Yeah.
Now, there becomes a point, to kind of get it, push it to the close to where you said you started robbing people, doing shit, living that lifestyle, things that you would have never considered. We've heard about it on many shows and prior to this. But how bad did it get before it got better?
Well, at the end, I was living in Sailor Park. I got introduced to methamphetamines. So for about almost 9 months, almost a year, I was doing meth every single day along with heroin.
Were you an IV user too?
No.
So always, okay.
No.
Snorted.
I snorted, smoked meth.
So meth and heroin.
Yes.
Speedballs.
Yes.
All the time. Okay.
Every day. And I got down to about 175 pounds. And
you're a tall guy. You're a big guy.
6'2". So.
Right.
So I was down there, and I was living with this girl. And, you know, you can only live with me for so long before you can't no more, you right. know.
Especially if you're stealing everybody's shit and causing problems.
I am. I'm causing a lot of problems. I'm getting fronts from drug dealers and not paying them back. And I'm ribbing this guy off to go get something.
Yeah, robbing Peter to pay Paul, yeah. basically. And, okay.
It just got to the point where just to eat, I would have to go steal something from UDF just to get something to eat.
Sailor Park, UDF?
Yes. Yes.
I've been there.
I got to make amends for their hot dogs.
Yeah. Hey, man.
And I used to go in there and steal their hot dogs. I'd steal their buns, and I walk outside, and that's how I ate.
Right.
I could not imagine to spend $10 on a meal, you know?
Right, because I need to go to the drugs.
I got to get what I need to
get.
Dude,
I would do the same thing. I would have $20 in my pocket, need to eat something because I haven't eaten in days. And I would go and buy like a McDouble and, you know, and put maybe $3 in my gas tank and then short the dope boy. And,
yeah.
You know, that was what my life came to.
And that's what
my life lying to my mom in order to get it, all that other stuff. I mean, look, you said it got to the point where you were doing both heroin and methamphetamines every day, living with a girl. That's chaotic. It's like, because you're a drug addict. You're deep within it. And then what?
then she kicked me out. And
so you have nowhere to go.
And like I said, I always had my dad's house I could fall back on.
Okay.
I could. He let me live in the basement, you know. But at this point in time, I was so bad, I couldn't let my dad see me like
right.
this.
You were so embarrassed to, right.
I had to hide. And at this point, we slept in hallways of apartment complexes. I slept on friends' couches, or I'd be on meth, and we don't sleep at all.
Right.
You know, we stay up for 16 days at a time, losing our minds. And it just got to that point, man, where I didn't want to live that way no more. I was homeless pretty much, and I've never been that way. Like, I was always almost like a functioning drug addict for a long time.
You were just
time.
Existing. You were miserable, though, too. Had already clocked out many years prior to that.
Yeah, in 2011 I clocked out. This was 2015. Really, I clocked out before that. The first
you said
time
you
I
clocked
had
out, you started doing, I mean, look, you have a history of cheating.
Mm-hmm.
Not really living life, not really doing anything, and even with you've cheated all of this. That's been kind of a consistent thing in your life, and I don't want to point that out to piss you off. It's reality.
No, it's true.
You know, even when you were faced with a terrible circumstance of having cancer, like, you cheated your way through that too, and you took those medications, you sold. I mean, like, it's, you know, and then doctor shopping, and while something's terrible that happened to you, you really just, you've never really done anything.
No.
You haven't. And That's the tragedy in all this, right? Like, yeah. You were just like, fuck it. If I'm going to be here, might as well be high throughout the whole thing. I want to die. Now it gets to the point where you're doing not only heroin, methamphetamines, living on the streets, you know, trying to just keep that ugliness going.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just get tired of it.
Yeah.
What was that tired like?
I just remember calling my dad, and it was the first. Like, my mom used to call me at points, and she'd tell me I need to get help and all this stuff, and, you know, I would cuss her out, you know. Fuck you. You don't know what I'm going through. You don't get it. And I would hang up on her and ignore her phone calls for weeks at a time, you know. But this was the first time ever in my life I actually reached out to my dad. And I just cried, and I said, I need help, man. I need help.
You've never asked for help
before. No, never.
Literally, I've never.
Never in my life.
Because I haven't heard you say one thing about that. You were just like, you're so fucking worn out from all of this.
Yeah. Just my whole life from 21 to 28 was just ugly.
Constant just degradation, ugly.
Between chemotherapy and opiate addiction, my 20s were fucked.
Right.
You know,
and you're only 31 now. So really, I mean, that's why having this conversation with you, I recognize, like, look, you haven't done anything other than get high and run, really, is all you've done. And now you have finally, because you talked about your dad being your rock at the beginning of this conversation,
mm-hmm.
somebody that, you know, had always had your back in some way, whether you were trying to reach it or not. You know what I mean? Like, he was always there. He was always, and you loved him and you respected him enough. You didn't want to, you were embarrassed to let him see what you were like. But finally, at the end of it, you call your dad and say, I need help.
Yeah.
And what's he do?
I was up at Mercy Hospital on Boudinot, and because, of course, I was going up there trying to med seek, which didn't work. And
you red flagged, I'm
sure.
Yeah.
And so he came and he picked me up, and he had my niece with him. And I was going through withdrawals, and my niece was, you could see the fear in her eyes just because of what I was going through. And she kept asking me, like, what's wrong, Kyle? What's wrong? And I just was like, Kyle's sick. Kyle's got the flu.
Right.
And but in reality, I was coming off a lot of shit. You know, I was coming off methamphetamines. I was coming off benzos. I was coming off heroin. there's a lot of things I was going, I was coming off of. And so I told him, so my dad's like, so what are you going to do different? And I'm like, I said, I will do anything. I said, I'll go to the meetings everyone talks about. Cause at this point in time, I've never been to a 12-step meeting in my life.
Right.
Never. And I never thought I'd ever be in one, you know, right. Really. I thought I was going to live this way for the rest of my life. I thought this is who I'm going to be.
Right. Well, that's all you really had been, though.
Yeah, and that's all I've known. That's all I've known. I didn't know how to get a job. I didn't know how to wake up for work every day. I didn't know how to be a son, be a grandson, be a uncle.
No.
You know, I ran. That's what I do is I run. And, you know, and so my dad was like, well, what are you going to do different? And I was like, I'll go to church. I'll go to 12-step meetings. I don't.
Whatever it takes. Yeah, please, I need help.
I just need help. And he's like, all right. He's like, you can come. And he let me come up to his house. And I was trying to get into Cat House, which.
This is a 28-day treatment center in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Yeah. And I could not get in. You know, you know how Cat House is. It's. Fool, keep calling back. And I'm just like, I just couldn't do it. And at this time, you know, there's many different places around here now. Even then that I didn't know about, you know.
Right. I mean, that's just one that people have talked about.
Yeah, like, I just always heard people say, oh, I'm going to the Cat House.
Right.
I'm going to the Cat House. And I've never been the no house, you know.
Right.
So I didn't know what else to do, you know. I was like, I'm trying to get in here, and I'm like, you know what? I had like two Subutex, and I'm like, I'm gonna take these for a couple of days, and but I was doing fentanyl at the end. So to me, when I'm doing fentanyl, it feels like Suboxones don't even work.
They don't work at all, right?
They don't work, and I was taking them, even though I was still feeling like shit because they didn't work, but I was just taking them because it was something, you know. And I laid there on my dad's couch for 3 days, and I had a 5-gallon bucket that I was just puking in.
Mm.
I was laying there, and I don't know. To this day, the only thing I can say that made me stay is God's grace.
Well, you had never been exposed to it. You were exhausted. You're going through withdrawal, like, heavy for days at your dad's house, puking into a bucket. I mean, by the grace of God, you didn't go and get drugs.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
You stayed there, right?
Yeah. Well, I called one of my drug dealers,
right,
off my dad's house phone, because of course my phone got who knows where
right.
I was at. And I was so weak I could barely even talk, and he didn't even recognize if it was me, and he's like, this is not Kyle, and he hung up on me.
Hmm.
I was trying to get him to bring me something, and he wouldn't do it because he said it didn't sound like me,
right,
which is today a blessing,
right?
You know,
well, you didn't sound like you though either.
No.
You were beat.
Yeah, I was beat down, man. I was beat. And
so you detoxed at your dad's.
I detoxed 3 days at my dad's house. I got rushed to the hospital.
Think about everything you're coming off of.
Yeah, on day two I got rushed to the hospital, and I stayed at I went to UC hospital, which is terrible. They made me sit in the waiting room, and I just took a piece of Subutex and I left because
right.
It was just like, I ain't going to sit here for 5 hours. And then on day four, my friends were all over at a sober living house. I knew a bunch of guys that were at a house. And like I said, I seen them on Facebook and stuff, and they're all sober, and I was down there miserable as hell, and they all looked happy, and I finally reached out to them, and I tried to get in the house, and at the time, they didn't have a bed open.
Right.
They said the house is full, and they said, but you can sleep on the couch if you want to sleep on the couch until a bed opens, because you know how them houses are.
Yeah, right.
Eventually going to open.
Yeah, sooner or later.
So I'm like, all right, I'll do it. You know, I'll sleep wherever I got to sleep, you know. And I went there, and I actually made I made a bed on the floor out of pillows, and I slept there. And I was still detoxing. I really didn't sleep much. And I didn't sleep at all at the beginning. And I started hallucinating coming off of...
I've done that shit.
Benzos and coming off of heroin and all meth. And I was hallucinating. I thought people were outside trying to kill me. I even went as far as walking up the street. And I have no recollection of doing it.
Right.
They said I was just walking up the street, and I don't know why. I don't know.
No, well, you're also detoxing off of a serious amount of substances.
Yeah. And I was out of my mind, and I got rushed to the hospital. They rushed me to the hospital, and I was at Mercy Hospital for 3 or 4 days. And really, I don't remember being there. I slept pretty – that was like the first time I slept in probably 15 right. days.
But you're being monitored.
I was detoxing, and I couldn't sleep for about the first 15 days. And I went up there, and they kept me on an IV and monitoring me, and I slept. I slept for the first time, and it was almost like I was in a blackout, like when I was hallucinating, because it's like people tell me I was doing these things,
and you
don't remember doing them. Like the doctor really thought I was on drugs. He thought I was on acid, and I wasn't. I was detoxing, and so I was there for 3 or 4 days, and I went back to the sober living house when I left there, and no one thought I'd come back. Everyone's like, dude, that dude's gone. You
right.
know, and I came back, man, and I just wanted a different way of life. I wanted to try something different finally, you know.
And that's the amazing thing, right? So that's like where this triumph starts, is to look at all of the ugly shit from your past. You've never had any semblance of recovery. No recovery whatsoever. No. You just assume you're destined to die that way. And then just by a moment of clarity, says, I can't live like this anymore. I need help. Reach out to your dad. You stay there for a little bit. Get rushed to the hospital. Come back. Go and staying a sober living or still like detoxing off of many years of drug abuse, yes. right? Consistently, right? And then, you know, go to the hospital again for a handful of days. No one thinks you're going to come back. They just assume you're so fucked up and spaced out, like that Kyle, there's something wrong. Kyle's done for.
Yeah.
But yet you show back up at the sober living after you get released from the hospital. Like, I got to do something different. Like, this change in you was deep seated. And you're right. It had to have come from something greater because you didn't, it doesn't make any sense on any other way, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, so now you're in a sober living house with a bunch of guys that are trying to change their life. You want, because you said you saw him on Facebook and saw him smiling. Like, you haven't smiled in forever. Like,
I haven't smiled.
None of that shit. Like, that's the thing people don't seem to remember. Like, that's a fucking miserable existence, right?
Yeah.
And that's the tragic shit. So now you are being surrounded by people who have your back. Your dad has your back. He's encouraging you to do this. You're there. And, you know, so this is you getting clean and sober.
Yeah. And I stayed there for 11 months. Throughout that period of time, you know, I was getting an SSI check from when I had cancer and all that, and I milked that. You know,
well, it is what it is. But you know what? Like, you weren't getting high.
Yeah.
Let's just call that what it is. Like, you know what? Milking this. Like, dude, look. You are not still doing it.
No.
You've moved on from that.
Yeah,
but you were rebuilding. You're going to talk about many years of doing all sorts of just terrible shit.
Terrible.
And now you said you stayed in this house, the sober living for 11 months, surrounded by guys that are trying to get clean and sober, having new experiences, something that you've never done before, going to meetings, right?
Yes.
Going to meetings.
We were required to go to 4 12-step meetings a week.
Okay.
So that's what I did. And for the first 11 months, you know, I didn't work. I was getting my check. I would pay my little,
rent. Yeah.
You know, and my dad would help out as well because he just wanted me to do good. You know? And he would help me out, and I would just go to meetings. I mean, there at the beginning, I was going two, three meetings a day. You know? Just because I had nothing else to do.
And you damn sure didn't want that other life.
Yeah, so I was just like, I'll do whatever it takes. And, you know, the first meeting I ever went to, you know, and I liked it for the first. I mean, I always judged them. Like, I'll never go to them damn things. Right. You know.
Until you go, you're like, oh.
Then I go, and it's like a room full of guys like us, and it's just like, this is kind of cool, you know. And to see them all sober and happy, and I just remember my first meeting, I was sitting there and I was just like, I just want that.
Right.
Like, if my life is, I'm on an SSI check for the rest of my life, but I'm happy like this man, I will be okay.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's all I wanted.
It's a little bit of hope.
Yeah. I just wanted peace. I just wanted happiness inside. You know, I was tired of wearing this mask, faking it for so long.
And it's just getting fucking worse and worse and worse.
It's just like, I really want that.
So then, all right, so you go to a meet, you're starting doing meetings, you're living in this sober living for 11 months, you are collecting a check, but now you're not anymore, and you got to go to work, right?
Well, what happened is, I was living there for 11 months, and I figured it was my time to go, you know? I was well into my recovery, I was surrounded by people in my 12-step program, and I feel like I was ready to move on from that place. And I also didn't agree with a lot of things that was going on. And,
I mean, it happens.
We won't go into details on that, but I wasn't agreeing with what was going on. And
well, it's transitional living for a reason, right? You're not supposed to stay in a sober living house for the rest of your life.
No.
It's supposed to help you get back on your feet, and it helped you get back on your feet. Yeah, regardless of the circumstances that surround that, you knew that was time for you to move forward.
Yeah, it did its job.
Right.
You know, and that's what it's there for. And I lived there for 11 months. I moved out with a friend. My friend had a house over in Westwood area, and he said he needed help on his rent because he was also in recovery himself.
There you go.
And he's like, he asked me if I wanted to move in with them and help him on the rent, and I said, sure. And I was working, and that's when I started to work at ADAPT.
Okay, so ADAPT was a inpatient men's treatment center. You start working to help out guys that are early in recovery.
Yeah.
Like how crazy that is. You have your experience, right, has been on the other side of the coin. Like you've never really had a job before.
No, this was my first real job.
First real job out of, like, in your recovery is working with people that are in recovery.
Yeah.
Or trying to be, you know, working for a treatment center, even if it's court ordered, right? Yeah. So now you're there. You're doing this the day in, day out, finally collecting an honest paycheck.
Yeah.
First time really in a...
Ever.
Ever. Dude, I said that's a triumph. Like, look, just by doing a program of recovery, now all of a sudden you're being able to stand on your own two feet. Like, really?
Yeah.
That's huge. Under the constraints of this conversation. Like anybody, normal person can look at someone and say, everybody has a job. But for someone who really never had one and who has never had recovery or anything like that, and now this is monumental.
It's a big deal. For me, it was.
It's a big deal for me just hearing it and even knowing and having, you know, we've spent some time together over the past couple of years because I went through that treatment center. And that's what's so funny to hear it now, like how you actually got there and to have conversations with you while I was there about, like, dude, I'm tired of this life. Like, I could go back and forth, but you're so fresh in it as well. So it only reinforces what you're doing too because you get it and you're like, look, I'm just trying to get better myself.
Yeah.
That's a big deal, dude. That's huge.
Yeah.
So now you carry this because now you talked about in the beginning of this that you work for a Hotel California by the Sea Cincinnati, which is a treatment center and support, like a handful of things. So just give me, so we can kind of get an idea of wrapping this up, of like, since you started at that treatment center, not the one you're at right now, but ADAPT, like what is, how's this moved on the next couple of years? Because you've been, how long have you been clean and sober?
I've been sober 3 years and 4 months.
Okay, so that's a lot, and you've never had that much time in your whole life.
Never.
But in that 3 years and 4 months, give me like bullet points of all the cool things that have happened.
In the last 3 years, I got my license taken away, of course, for DUI in 2013. Just the small stuff as well, I got my license back. I got to go get a car off a car lot 2 years ago and put it in my name, which was
huge.
It's huge for a guy like me, I got my own house there for a while, until I made a rational decision, but you live and you learn.
Right.
I started out at Talbert House, and I'll tell you there, you made $10.10 an hour doing the job that I did, but it was my first job ever.
So, right.
And I wanted to get in this field, and I knew that experience is everything.
Right.
And
you had plenty of that.
And I had personal experience, but far as working in the field is also, I need experience to expand.
Right.
So I started out there, and I was just like, I'm going to work here for a little while, and then I'll move on and see what happens and see what happens. And then I moved on, and I made $14 an hour at Beckett Springs, And it's just like, as long as I keep doing what I'm doing and trusting the process and trusting God, seems like his plans work out a lot better than mine.
Yeah, you're damn right about that.
I could have been at Talbert House making $10.10 an hour and said, fuck this shit. I'm going back to do what I used to
right.
do.
Because in all
reality,
it's
$300 a week.
Right.
And it's just like, how the fuck am I going to
live? Yeah, how am I going to live? Like, I mean, I get it. But you know what? You stuck it through.
I stuck it
until something else came up.
And I trusted the process, And I put my faith in my higher power that this is all going to work out,
right?
As long as I just keep doing the next right thing. And, I talked to my sponsor about it, and he said the same thing. Like, I'll just trust God, man. Trust God that it's going to work out. And it was hard to do at times, And sometimes I just want to be like, screw it.
Right.
Shit's
hard.
But then when I feel that way, I just went to one of my meetings and go up there and talk to the guys and get their experience on newly sober, getting jobs, and just kept getting better. And as long as I stayed out of it, I had to stay out of it and just put in the footwork. And so I started going to Beckett Springs, and I worked out there for a while, and then I got a call from Hotel California, and he wanted me to come in and talk to him. And so I'm like, all right, I'll go up there and talk.
Right.
We'll see what happens, And we went and talked. We had a good long talk. And this was last June. And he's like, all right, well, we'll be opening soon. Because at this time, we weren't even open yet.
Right. He was just trying to get good people.
He was just trying to get guys to work and have it all set up for when they do open up. And couple months went by, and I'm just like, and I text him.
Yeah, like, dude, like, yeah, you can't interview me and leave me hanging that.
And I just, all I'd say is, hey, I'm really looking forward to hearing back from you.
Right.
I really would love to be a part of your company here. And, I just kept in touch with him and just, hey, how's things going? And eventually he called me in July. And he's like, Kyle, I want to offer you a job. And I'm like, all right. And so I took the job with him, and I left Beckett Springs.
Right.
And it was probably the best decision I ever made in my life.
I think getting sober was the best decision you ever made in your life.
Yeah,
I mean, no, it's like, because all of this stuff is just a bonus to that.
Yeah.
Because at the beginning, you said, I just am tired of living like this, and now you have a life that just continues to, like, these are all awesome things.
Yeah.
And I know that recovery is not just, like, a
material
it's,
shit.
Right, it's you not, know? You know what I mean? Like, I'm not concerned what you
that's
make an hour.
Bonus,
like, that's the thing. Like, you get to be able to look at, look at yourself in the mirror and like the person you see. You get to be, you know, an uncle to your little, your niece. Like, the one that saw you so deathly afraid of you.
Mm-hmm.
You get to be a son again and a friend and make new associations and create something for yourself, which are all triumphs, in my opinion. I would
Absolutely.
Hope that they're for you as well. It's really an amazing thing, right? And to have this conversation with you and to look at your whole life and say, okay, I ran from this, I cheated on this, I had cancer, I got through that, I was filled with self-centered fear, I was filled with this, never had any recovery, finally so beaten down, right? And you're right, that there's only one way that can be described as an act of God, because there's so many people that don't get that opportunity, but yet you have it and you've taken it, and that's been your life since. So in 3 years and 4 months, you've gone from a guy literally stealing hot dogs, you know what I mean?
From UDF
to doing what you do now. And that is a story of from tragedy to triumph. It is. And I'm so grateful you came in today. What I'd like to do is just give somebody who is still struggling an idea, you know, if you could say something to them, what would it be?
If I could say something to them, I would say surrender is the key. Willingness is the key. That you don't have to live like that no more if you don't want to. There is a way out. And you just got to trust the process. Life's not, you can't get sober and think that your life's going to be great right away. It's just not how this thing works. I mean, I guess it works for some people that way, but most of us don't come in here on a winning streak. You know, most of us come in here beat down. And all we can do is trust the process. It's the only thing we can do, and just trust God, trust your higher power, trust that this is the right thing to do. And as long as you stay around us and do what we do, you can have what we have, you know. And I'm willing to show anybody how to get it, you know. I'll show them how I did it, and that's what I'm try to do on a daily basis, is to show people hope at work and leave work and go to a meeting. Like, my whole life is revolved around recovery, and I know that my job cannot be my recovery. I know that I gotta have my job as my job. I'm there for money to support myself,
right?
But I'm also there to talk to the guys and give them hope, but I also gotta do my 12 steps as well.
You got to get your own hope.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because if I don't, you can get... Everyone thinks that, oh, if you work in recovery, you don't... Shit, you're good.
Don't work like that.
Dude, I'll get more crazy.
Yeah. Trying to fix everybody else's problems.
Staying in the madness is what it is, because they're all newly sober.
Yeah,
they're
insane.
All sick, and I'm sitting right in the middle of the sickness, and if I don't treat my addiction, I can be just as fucked up as they are, you
right.
know, and so I know that. But if there's one thing I could tell somebody is, we don't have to live like that no more. You know, there is a way out. So,
well, Kyle, I want to thank you for coming in. That was absolutely a story from tragedy to triumph. Yeah, thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
It's your host, Aaron Lane. Until next time, do big things.